Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Okay, but today we're going to talk about, we'll finish up talking about alcohol, as I mentioned, and then we'll talk about, well, basically tranquilizers. So we talked about the effects. Now let's talk a bit. One of the big effects is the effect on reaction time. Now, reaction time, so basically how do you measure that? It's really pretty simple. You give somebody a signal, and then they have to respond somehow. So it might be some kind of hitting a button, something like that. There's an old episode of WKRP from way back in the day when I was a child where Dr. Johnny Fever actually gets quicker reaction time when he drinks. It's a classic, and apparently they were the only people in the room old enough to, well, you should remember that. Yeah, the three of us remember that episode. Classic episode. Still, nonetheless, really what happens is your reaction time gets horrible. Like it gets really bad. And it even gets really bad with very small amounts of alcohol. Now this is something you can't really test on your own because you don't have a reaction time testing device sitting at home. But take my word that your reaction time gets worse. And so we got reaction time is one thing. It's going to affect driving because I don't drive a car because that would be bad for the people of Ontario. But with my vision, I may not drive a car. I can drive a car. I just may not. I know, however, my reaction time gets horrible playing online video games after, like, a beer. I can't play Modern Warfare 2 online at all once I've had a beer. So pretty much past 9 o'clock, I stop playing, if you know what I mean, every night. There are perceptual effects. We talked about things like flicker fusion, right? So, and of course, with a lot of alcohol, you might even hallucinate things. Conceivably, okay? There are memory issues. Now think about this. Do you remember that you hit your signal to turn? I mean, simple little things like that are automatic, usually. Your steadiness. And this is the classic, this is the old drunk test they used to use before they had, breathalyzers. You know, put your feet together. Put your hand out with your eyes closed and touch your nose, which is trivial to do if you've not been drinking. Do it the next time you've had maybe two beers. You just had like two beers, and it's not enough that you feel drunk at all. You just feel like, oh, I've had two beers. Try that. You'll miss. It's bizarre. You'll go like this. You go, yeah, well, of course it's going to, oh my. It'll surprise the heck out of you. And the effects themselves last longer than when the alcohol is in the system. In other words, even when it's mostly excreted, you still have all these effects from not sleeping the night before, etc. And this is going to be always worse the less amount of experience you have driving. So the younger you are, now of course at some level, once you hit 80, you're hard to drive anyway. Sitting really close up, driving 20 kilometers an hour. But I'm talking, within regular sort of adult range. This is harder with younger people because they haven't had the behavioral tolerance. They aren't used to drinking. They aren't used to the effects. I'm not saying if you get older, this won't work on a cop. But I'm 30. I've been drinking since I was 17. That's not going to help you. But in fact, you will be able to probably drive a little bit better drunk than a 17-year-old. That said, I wouldn't suggest any of you do it. Interesting data here. Here's blood alcohol level. 0.5, that's the legal limit in Ontario. 0.8 is the old legal limit. Okay? And this is the relative probability of you being in an auto accident. Now, I'll tell you something. First of all, blowing a 0.8, if you've ever played with a breathalyzer, 0.8, you are hammered. That's pretty drunk. Paul Dupuy and I talked about this once because he was also, somebody had one at U of T, so we used to drink and see why you could blow. It was like a competition. Things you do in graduate school. Paul had one because they were always interested in these sort of criminal justice kind of things and sort of forensic psychology. And he said he's never been able to blow. Like, he was so drunk that when he blew a .8, it was like, I got to stop drinking, though. I'm going to be sick. And I felt the same way. I don't think I've ever gone, at least whenever we tried it. 0.85 is about as far as I got. And it was like, oh, God, 0.085. And it was like unpleasant. That's like this kind of, And you can see, suddenly it goes up to 5%, 5% more likely. Look at what happens here. Now, this is somebody who These are all from different experiments. Look what happens when you get up around 150.15. That's twice the legal limit. You will hear that on the radio, and this person had this in their alcohol in their bloodstream. Sorry, three times the new legal limit. 0.15. You blow a 0.15, first of all. That's like drinking a 26er in about an hour. That's really professional. That's professional drinking. Look at this. So you're talking what? 30% relative. There's a 30% chance you're going to get in a car accident. I'm not a preachy person, but don't drink drunk. Yep.
If someone is a quote unquote professional alcoholic, yeah, and run with blood alcohol level, mm-hmm, constantly.
Yeah.
For them to pull three times.
Yeah.
They may still be walking.
No, that's an interesting point, because, in fact, what's happening there is the behavioral tolerance. Like, there's all these effects, but they're used to compensating for them, right? And we've talked about that, how a lot of times you have people your friend will come to you and say, I'm an alcoholic, and you'll say, I know you like to drink, but I had no idea. And they say, well, I'm drunk right now, and you don't seem drunk. It's an interesting point you're making. But the point is also that most people aren't like that. And also, again, blowing a 0.15 and saying, but officer, I'm an alcoholic. I'm used to driving drunk. It's not going to work. And also, still, even though they'll probably be able to do what you or I could conceivably do at a 0.7 or something like that, they're still impaired. They're still impaired. Yep. You're operating a big weapon when you're driving a car. People have to keep that in mind, I think. The one thing I'll always preach about in this class is don't take any drugs and drive a car. It's a bad idea. Everything else, I don't care. That can affect me, so don't do it. I don't care what you do to yourself as long as it doesn't affect me. When it affects me, it bugs me. You ever punch somebody to take their keys? Good times. Your friend who went to jail for drunk driving. Then he finally got his license back. After a year, they suspended it. Then he got drunk and tried to drive. We knocked him down, punched him in the face, and took his keys, for which he was not happy, but he was thankful the next day. I'll say that much. One of the things that happens is disinhibition. I talked about this the other day. We get a weakening somehow. And again, notice it says seems to. This is all sort of pharmacologically and neurologically really unsatisfactory, and that's because we don't really know. It probably weakens connections between cortical areas and motor areas. Cortical is your planning, the wrinkly bits of your brain. And motor areas, of course, how you drive, etc. So we weaken these connections. So we may think one thing and do something else. So a lot of the inhibition of doing something stupid, and I talked about, you run into somebody on the street normally, what do you say? Sorry. If you've been drinking, you say, what's your problem? You want to go? Right? Because that sort of reasoning part of you isn't now connected to the motor part as much. So it's hard to stop doing something once you've started it. Something like, for example, and you can find this just when you're walking. Right? Normally, if you have a little tiny stumble, you don't fall. You just keep going. If you take a step just a little bit the wrong way, you're like, whoa, when you're drinking, right? It's an old Latin expression, in vino veritas, which means in wine comes truth. And again, I think many of us have had the experience of sitting beside somebody on an airplane. Ever been on a long airplane trip? Or in a bar in a hotel where everyone's lonely and you're just sitting there by yourself having a couple of beers and some idiot's sitting there and he starts telling you his life story because he's had 16 martinis. He meets you and in 5 minutes you've seen pictures of his kids and you've heard the story about how he once cheated on his wife and you're like, I don't want to know this. And then he tries to sell you insurance. I think I've had that actual experience before. It's sort of a truth serum, in essence, because again, normally you don't tell people these things that are intimate, close details about yourself, especially that you just meet. But you'll do that when all the inhibition you have to do those things has been inhibited. All right? It is often said that the worst day for spousal abuse in the United States is Super Bowl Sunday. It is often said. It is simply not true, however. This wouldn't surprise us, in fact, because it's a bunch of guys drinking. But there is no truth to this. You'll hear this. This is one of those things people, you say it enough, people go, oh yeah, that's true. If you look it up on Snopes.com, which is a great place to look up urban legends, they've actually traced where it comes from.
And it's all just a bunch of miscommunication and somebody lying in the first place. So it simply isn't true. The worst night is actually apparently New Year's Eve. Now that is a lot of drinking New Year's Eve. It's also the worst night for car accidents. The second worst, by the way, being New Year's Day when people are driving hungover. A bit about tolerance and withdrawal. You can get acute and chronic tolerance. Acute tolerance is just right now, and this is while you are drinking. The first beer has a lot more effect than the second beer. Right? And once you've sort of hit that plateau stage, think about how it works, right? You got absorption, plateau, excretion. As long as you're keeping it at plateau because you keep drinking, and you're not drinking a whole lot more, it's going to have less of an effect. So that's acute tolerance. Chronic tolerance is over longer periods of time. You need more and more to get the effect. Right? So when you first, the more you drink, the more of a drinker you are, the more it takes to get you drunk. Right? Now, one of the things we have to also worry about here with tolerance and withdrawal is the microsomal ethanol oxidizing system, or the MEOS. That's that parallel system that kicks in when you've got a lot of alcohol in you. But remember what happens if you drink way too much? It actually shuts down. You also get behavioral tolerance, which we were just talking about, which is this idea of being used to being drunk. You get used to it. We talked about that with rats before, things like that. It's just the ability to basically, in essence, you know what the effects are and you can sort of compensate for them. There's minor withdrawal, which is like a hangover. In fact, it is true that to cure or to put off a hangover, you could have a shot of vodka. That will put off a hangover. It will not make it go away. It will come back. And most of us usually, you know, you wake up and you get that taste of alcohol in your mouth. The last thing you want is alcohol. But in fact, one quick shot, it's what a friend of mine used to do, my buddies at McGill, they used to get up and then they'd drink beer and eat Oreo omelets. This was how they, that was their, what they called their hangover cure. Oreo omelets, pretty gross. It's pretty gross. So is drinking beer. You've been drinking beer till 5 o'clock in the morning, go to sleep, wake up at 9. Yeah. But that's what minor withdrawal is like. Major withdrawal is a bit different. This is like 12 hours later. This is after 12 hours after drinking. This is for someone who is has an alcohol problem, alcoholic if you want. Now you get the DTs, delirium tremens. That's the feeling like there are bugs crawling on your skin. This can involve as well visual hallucinations, because that's an hallucination. There's also visual hallucinations, the proverbial pink elephant, right? This probably has something to do, we talked about this, with GABA, right? Because basically, glutamate. It's probably that the body makes more glutamate than it needs. Yeah, please, Steph.
What did you say DTs
were? Delirium tremens. Delirium spelled like delirium and tremens. Tremens, excuse me. T-R-E-M-E-N-S. T-R-E-M-E-N-S. No problem. Self-administration, well, what's self-administration? It's drinking. We talked earlier in the course about how it's going to be sometimes hard to get animals to have similar patterns of self-administration to humans because they may not like taking the drug. This was something that was a real problem for doing animal studies of alcohol. Because you could get animals drunk, it's something you could do, but it would be hard to make them drink it of their own accord if you know what I'm talking about here. Lynn Honey, who has a PhD in psychology, this is her PhD research, but she also has an honors BA from Algoma University. And this was her master's thesis. What they did is they forced alcohol on the mothers. Okay? So they had nothing else to drink except water. Except alcohol. So they drink alcohol. And then the pups, of course, when they're nursing, end up with, well, a white Russian. Sort of a, you know, like the Big Lebowski. In that case, when they grow up, those pups, And when rats grow up, that's a month. Like, rats don't live long. They'll actually self-administer alcohol. When given the choice, they will drink alcohol at certain times. In fact, what they'll do is they'll titrate the doses. They'll get a little drunk. And in fact, what rats do typically is they eat a meal. Most animals do this. They don't just eat all day long. And they would actually have a little cocktail hour before food. A couple of drinks, you know, pretty interesting stuff. So she actually ended up finding a way to get rats to drink of their own accord. They made the choice to drink, to self-administer. Pretty different. Not something we tend to think of with rats. Pretty cool experiment. There are big cultural effects we can think of between cultures. You can think of places like the biggest consumer of beer in the world is the Czech Republic, followed by Germany, followed by Canada. Right? You can think of cultural effects. That's just about beer. You can think about wine. Drinking wine is much bigger in, say, France, Italy, than it is in, say, the States. And I mean, like, drinking wine with dinner and that kind of thing in the age of onset, right? Even within our own country, there's big differences. Big differences, right? So we can think of between, say, Quebec, which is much more of a sort of European approach where people tend to be drinking wine with meals a lot more even when they're younger, compared to, well, say, Ontario even, where it's much less common. Biggest drinkers in Canada are Quebecers and Newfoundlanders. Those of you who have been to Quebec or Newfoundland, we're already aware of this. No, I'm serious. I mean, it's a much more of an alcohol society. Yes, you drink more. I lived there for 6 years, Dwayne. Yeah. Replaced water. Yeah, it's better. It's actually better than the water. It's all brown. Ladies and gentlemen, by the way, Dr. Keogh got his PhD on Thursday. And he turned 30 today. 30. He's old. I'm mocking him relentlessly now. It's great. Because he's old. Big cultural effects, like I said, even within our own country. There are age effects. As people get older, they tend to drink a little less, but they tend to drink more expensive alcohol. You can afford, right? You can suddenly afford to buy decent wine, decent beer, decent scotch, whatever. So they may actually spend more money on alcohol, but they tend to drink less. There's a lot less binge drinking, as they call it, which I don't like that expression because that just means getting drunk now and then. Makes it sound like it's all evil. It's kind of value-laden, you know? But there's a lot less, it's Thursday. Now, or I'm sorry, what is it now? Isn't Wednesday the new Thursday? So the heavy drinking starts Wednesday night and goes pretty much until Sunday afternoon. There's a lot less of that when you have jobs and such. There are sex effects. Men drink more than women. Men also can tolerate more alcohol than women, so it makes quite a bit of sense. That tends to be kind of cross-cultural. So does the age thing. The culture, of course, obviously can't be cross-cultural or it wouldn't be any cultural effect. There are cultures, of course, that ban alcohol. We know that, right? Most Muslim countries pretty much ban it, or it's not banned because there might be non-Muslims there, but it's really frowned upon. I can tell you, however, my wife's traveled in both Algeria and Morocco, and people there drink. They just don't tell their imam. Not everybody, but there's a lot more alcohol consumed than you would probably expect. Consumption is affected by price and availability. When people say that having wine and beer in corner stores would actually not affect the amount of drinking, that's just not true. There's studies like this that are done where these kind of things are deregulated and we go from having, say, state-run stores to making it more available. People drink more. They just do. They do. I don't know if that's an argument against selling alcohol in corner stores. I don't think it is because I'm a grown-up and I'll drink if I want to, thank you. And price as well. Right? Now, you might say, wait a second, Dave, alcohol's cheaper in the States. Yeah, it is. Ridiculously cheaper. You know? Hey, look, a 60-ounce bottle of vodka for $9. That kind of thing. On the other hand, see, that's a cultural effect. We don't live in the States. When alcohol goes down in price, the consumption goes up. When it goes up in price, the consumption goes down. This shouldn't really surprise us. It's a commodity. Right? Alcoholism? Anyway, by the way, questions about that? That's all stuff that makes sense, eh? Okay. Alcoholism itself, that's really, the term alcoholism is from the disease model. This was, Jelinek was one of the first people that talked about this, a sort of the physical dependence model of alcohol consumption. What that means is that it's a disease and you can't help but drink alcohol. Tolerance is shown to alcohol, of course. The big thing with the idea of alcoholism and it being a disease is this notion of loss of control. And I don't mean loss of control of you lose control of your life, which often happens to people that have an alcohol problem. I'm talking about loss of control. They drink one drink, and they're back drinking. You know that thing? It's like, well, no, I'm an alcoholic. You might know alcoholics, and they go, no, I can't have one. I'll just... Is that off or on the wagon? What wagon? You're off it, right? When you're not... I'm not reprising that Seinfeld bit from that episode. Seriously, I can't remember which one it is. You're off when you're drinking, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They can't go off because then they'll be off forever and then they have to go back through treatment, etc. That's the whole notion, right? The data actually show that a reasonable thing for a drinker, a heavy drinker, an alcoholic, is to be able to learn to go back to social drinking. To be able to have a glass of wine or two with dinner. To be able to have a couple of beers with their friends after, I don't know, what do people want to play golf, play hockey? I don't know, whatever the hell people do. Right? The data actually show that. Because there are treatment programs that involve teaching people about alcohol. This is like lore. This is almost like an urban myth, this notion. Because the data don't show it. It's a reasonable thing for people to learn to be able to drink properly. The loss of control thing, there's no real evidence behind it. Now, is it probably good? A lot of people that have alcohol problems, like even if they could, they'd probably say, I really don't want to. Right? They might like have bad memories, yada, yada. That's all horrible. But it's a reasonable goal for someone who drinks too much, to have a real alcohol problem, to be able to go back and have a drink now and then. Right? A lot of people talk about FHP or family history positive. When you take a look at family history of alcoholism, yeah, it runs in families. And it seems like there's a genetic component to it, too. There's, you know, it's if you look at twins reared apart, things like that, you end up with a lot of cases where it seems to run in the family. That said, there's this whole notion that the differences are small and subtle. They're there. There's no denying that they are there. But it's not like if your dad's an alcoholic, you will become an alcoholic. You're more likely to, though, if your dad is an alcoholic, to be one. But there's subtle differences. Yes, Steph?
Could it also tie into cultural effects?
Of course.
For example, I'm an uncle is an alcoholic.
Sure.
And my grandparents came from Germany.
Yep.
And they drink beer there for breakfast.
Yes.
Lunch and supper.
Yeah.
And in between.
That's right.
So coming to Canada, that's totally different.
Yeah, and of course, it's our culture doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And, you know...
So, she's drinking like fine in Germany, but not in Canada.
It's more of a problem in Canada. Yeah exactly. In which case, there certainly are cultural effects there. I mean, what would be viewed as an alcohol problem, I think, in some places wouldn't be viewed other places. That said, I think everybody who has the more serious cases where someone devotes their life to alcohol, no matter where you live, that's a problem, right? But I think there's those sort of more subtle places, and some people call you an alcoholic, and other people would call you a guy who likes to drink beer. And there's six and one half dozen of the other sort of thing, right? But yeah, I think you're right. So the family history positive stuff's interesting, but the differences are subtle. There's also this idea of what are called gamma alcoholics. They're people that are almost alcoholics. Not much from there. Because the problem is identifying them is easy to do after they become alcoholics. It's usually looking back and you say, okay, what's your pattern of use before drinking, before becoming what we call an alcoholic? And you look and you say, okay, yeah, you drink a lot, yada, yada, yada. It's the prediction in advance isn't any good. Oh, I'm not saying, by the way, people don't have alcohol problems, but I'm not trying to say that, okay? Bad things that can happen from alcohol. Well, you could drink so much that you get poison. See, because it's a poison, right? And remember all those things like, all the metabolites are poisons too. So, you know, you can drink so much that it makes you very, very, very ill. Quote, alcohol poisoning. A hangover is unpleasant. That's a nasty effect, nasty side effect. Generally bad behavior, right? I mean things like getting in fights, unprotected sex with people you weren't married to, you know, things like that. Those are bad ideas. Now, here about sex, I'm not talking about how it can lead to sex. I'm talking about how it can lead to not being able to have sex, if you know what I'm saying. However, if you just follow, if you garnish your martini with Viagra, you're in, baby. It's no problem. I didn't. That's not how I meant you're in. It was more of an expression there. Come on. You guys are all giggly. You're in grade 4. The teacher said boobies. Remember that when your teacher would teach in sex education and she'd get all embarrassed up there? That was fun. Bad for your liver, because like your liver has to work really hard. And actually what ends up happening is that fat deposits get built up around your liver, which explains things like a beer gut. Right? You turn yourself into basically human foie gras. Korsakoff syndrome is really bad. Korsakoff syndrome involves drinking so much that your brain gets destroyed. Now, how does this happen? It used to be thought it was all just the alcohol. It doesn't seem to be just the alcohol. It's actually a lack of vitamin B. See, most people that devote their lives to drinking, well, I'm already drinking Guinness. I don't need to eat. You're full, so you don't eat. I don't know about you, but when I drink, I like to eat food. I like having munchies around and stuff like that. But I don't have the same kind of, you know, level of drinking we're talking about here. So you end up not eating properly. Your nutrition suffers. So more seems to be to do with vitamin B. What you end up with here, by the way, is someone who loses so much. They're literally, if you compare an MRI of someone with Korsakoff's and someone without it, anybody could spot it because, like, the brain's smaller and has holes in it. It's got lesions in it. This is this leads usually to Korsakoff syndrome involves amnesia, and I mean like you can't form any new long-term memories. Now you can have a conversation with somebody with Korsakoff's, like with anybody with long-term memory damage, and you may not even notice. But when you leave the room and come back, and they don't know who you are, that's when you notice. Of course, there's fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol effects. This leads to a series of birth defects that you've probably all heard about. Yes?
Is Korsakoff syndrome interchangeable with Wernicke?
No. Wernicke syndrome is a different kind of thing. Wernicke would be... Korsakoff-Wernicke. I'm kind of drunk. Korsakoff-Wernicke syndrome. But you have to say both of them, because if you just said Wernicke syndrome, you're talking about something that you might be talking about something that just involves Wernicke's area. So yeah, but Wernicke-Korsakoff, yeah. That's right. Fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol effects. I'm not quite sure why this happens, but this leads to... you can spot a kid with FA. Yes, you can spot them. They have their eyes are too close together. They tend to have cleft palate. They tend to be retarded, and they tend to have behavioral problems. Fetal alcohol effects is basically a milder version thereof. Okay? And there is very little hope for a kid with FAS. There's not much you can do. There's so much damage that was done, so many birth defects, that there's very little you can do. And this is why, I mean, we don't know what the safe level of alcohol is when a pregnant woman drinks. There must be a safe level, because up until about 30 years ago, women drank when they were pregnant. It was no big deal. We just don't know what the safe level is, and this is why I think you hear most MDs saying, just don't drink. I've also heard other MDs say, look, it's the odd glass of wine with dinner, the odd beer, it's not going to kill you. I think what they're afraid of is people will go, well, how much could I have? Well, maybe one every day, that's fine. And then they'd say, oh, really, one a day? Well, what I could do then is I could save up all seven and then drink seven tonight. No, you can't. That's, I think, what they're afraid of. But, I mean, I've heard many MDs say, look, there is a safe level. The odd glass of wine, the odd beer now and then isn't going to do anything. It's the lots of it. But no one really knows what the safe level is. That's why women are told, just don't drink alcohol. But I'll tell you something. If you see a pregnant woman having a drink, I don't want you doing this kind of thing. You're worse than Hitler. Because it really bugs me. Pregnant women are under enough stress as it is. If they have a beer now and then, Don't be judging them. It's enough work as it is. I'm such a liberated, you know, 21st century guy, aren't I? Isn't it impressive, really? I'm so sensitive. Anyway, seriously, I get really, it bugs me when I, because I've seen people like in restaurants, some pregnant woman who's, you know, she's, you can see it. They have a glass of wine and people like all stop, the whole restaurant stops and stares at her. Don't do that. Don't do that. You live in a steel town, for Christ's sake. It's probably breathing in that air is worse. Just saying. But, you know, if you see her falling down drunk, you might want to wonder. You know. There must be a safe level, we just don't know what it is. Because like I said, when I was, God, when my mom was pregnant with me, I'm sure she had the odd drink. That explains some things. But, you know, people, you ever watch that show Mad Men? But the early 60s, and they're drinking and smoking while they're pregnant. Yeah, it's, I love Mad Men. It might lead to cancer, liver cancer. Okay, so that's lots of it, eh? Like, this is lots in short periods. These. And this is lots over long periods. FAS is lots in a certain particular time. There are, however, good things about alcohol. Besides being exciting and fun to drink, and it's one of the wonderful arts is knowing how to mix a perfect martini. It's good for heart disease. Now, good means like a couple of drinks a day for a guy and one for a woman. But it's actually good for you. And it's not just red wine. They thought it was just red wine. And then they thought it was because of tannins. And they said, oh, darker beers have tannins. And then it turns out gin is fine. It's just alcohol. It's something to do with, no one really knows why. So then they thought it was beer. Now hard stuff. Like, so a glass of gin. Big glass, too. Like a, no, I'm talking a standard drink size here, okay? So there are some good things about alcohol. Plus, it's fun and cool, and you know, it makes you look grown up when you're drunk. Kidding. So, a couple of drinks a day is actually good for you. And again, saving them up and saying, "Well, if two a day is good, I'll stop. I won't drink for 10 days, and I'll have 20 tonight." That's not good for you. But it's funny because they've revised it. It was like one glass of wine. Now it's two drinks. I'm waiting for it to go up to like, you know, a 6-pack or, you know. It's okay to have a 26er or a rye every day. It's actually good for you. Treatment. How do we treat people with an alcohol problem, though? Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the most common treatment. And it has success for some people. It's got issues. Some people don't like it for reasons. It's based on this model that it's a disease, and some people don't like that. It may not be any better than quitting on your own. It may not be. The data are kind of iffy. It's hard because it's anonymous. It's hard to do research on something like this. But the research that's done looks like it's not nearly as effective as people. It's probably 60-odd%, but that's still pretty good. People used to think what we'll do is we'll put you on antidepressants because you're drinking because you're depressed. This is this notion of, you know, you self-medicating, and that's probably not true. Behavioral therapy works pretty decently, and cognitive behavioral therapy. So behavioral therapy involves things like sort of a learning approach. If you do this, this happens. In fact, one of the things that's done now is contracting. And when it works like this, you go in, it's all confidential, and you sign a contract with the person giving you the therapy saying, you can give me random breathalyzer tests. And if I blow that I've been drinking alcohol, you're going to tell the following people. People are motivated pretty nicely by embarrassment. The cognitive end of cognitive behavior therapy might throw that contracting thing in, and then also have, like, teaching people to take joy and reinforcement from other things in their life. The bottle has reinforcement in it. It feels good. But teaching people to take that from something else. Most people actually quit drinking like they do most drugs. They just do it on their own, cold turkey. Yeah. I'm not saying it's a good treatment option. I'm saying that people do it a lot. All right. Questions about alcohol? Cool.
So, we'll close that slideshow.
You might wonder how much of this, by the way, will be on the test, up until the part where I say, see, guys, then that's what's on the, up to there is on the test. So I might have to revise the test I've made up. I might not have to. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so let's talk about barbiturates and benzodiazepines. So along with the things like methaqualone, that's Quaaludes. Nobody takes Quaaludes anymore. And meprobromate, they're sedative hypnotic, which means they put you to sleep, or tranquilizers. Okay? That's what these drugs do. They're very similar, in fact, in their effects, their behavioral effects to alcohol. We basically call them tranquilizers. You know, if you've ever been to a hospital and something really bad's happened to you and you're kind of worked up, they may give you a shot of diazepam. Right? Or they may even give you Ativan, same kind of thing. Yep. The other thing they might do, for example, even if you come in and you bring somebody in and you're really worked up, they might say, just take this. Calm yourself down. Yeah, that's right. Slip it on your tongue. It'll dissolve. No, they're not going to give you a shot if you take somebody in. Here, start an IV on this guy just for the hell of it. That's not really how it works. But they might give you a pill. Mother's little helper. Basically like alcohol and gas sniffing, they facilitate the functioning of GABA, the universally inhibitory neurotransmitter. And we'll talk about how shortly they do this quite directly. Unlike alcohol, we go, I don't know. We actually pretty much know how this works. Up until early 1900s, late 1800s, basically for anesthetics, they used to use opium or brandy. Tasty, tasty brandy. Get you really drunk till you pass out and then operate on you. No, soldiers actually used to carry brandy with them. I mean, that's going back to like the Napoleonic Wars. But it was for, you know, getting drunk enough that you could have your leg amputated. Now then you get into like the Civil War in the States, it goes to opium. None of these things aren't nearly, probably not the greatest thing. Eventually MDs, these drugs come out, barbiturates, and they say, oh, these are much better. So they're using those. Things like phenobarbital. In fact, it's still used, phenobarbital, to prevent seizures. So somebody who's seizing quite a bit, you might give them phenobarbital. Think about what a seizure is. It's random, intense activity in the nervous system. If this is going to operate the GABA system, it's going to make that all less likely. Right? Sternbach et al. Discovered benzodiazepines by what we call brute force. They don't tend to do things like that anymore. The way new drugs are discovered now, typically, is you look at the molecule of something that you know what the properties are, and you start messing around with those properties, and you see how that molecule works with different receptors, and you can actually almost design a drug now. That's not how they did it. They just kept making compounds till they came up with these, what they called pretty crystals, and it turned out that when they gave it to animals, it slowed them down. They invented diazepam, or Valium, with a V, capital V. Now, one of the things that fits in this whole category is rohypnol, you know, date rape drug, as they call it. I'm not going to say this doesn't happen, because it does. I'm not going to say that women shouldn't be careful, because there's people out there that are bad. But every time you hear that there's a big rohypnol problem somewhere, and you're told, oh, there's people around and they're slipping things in people's drinks, turns out very often it's actually just a problem of people drinking too much. So I'm not saying women shouldn't be careful, because you should be, but you shouldn't be to the point where you're frightened of everything. I'm walking around with your drink covered all the time going, somebody's going to put something in my drink. No, I've seen women, I'm serious, I've seen women walk around. I'm not saying you shouldn't care and you shouldn't think about this and that some people are real jerks. And that would make you, in fact, I believe the word is criminal. But walking around paranoid, when you actually take a look at most of these cases, what happens is, I remember a famous case in, when they talked about this, it was back when I was living in Corner Brook, and they were saying that, you know, well, it must have been Rohypnol because three women have reported waking up after being out drinking in places they weren't aware they'd ever been, and they woke up and they'd, you know, been sexually assaulted. And you think to yourself, except for that last part of that story, which is horrible and should never happen, I have a simpler explanation. Somebody drank too much. I'm not saying the women deserved it and all that stuff. Please don't take it that way. I'm saying you shouldn't always be frightened that people are trying to put things in your drinks. Are people? Yes. There are also people out there that want to, that are serial killers. These things are unlikely. This is one of those drugs. It's not good for you, you know, with the drink. It's bad. It will knock you out. The reason it's used is because it's easy to find and it's cheap. You could use Valium and have the same effect. Yeah?
Is ketamine a barbiturate?
No. It's a kind of tranquilizer. It's quite similar, except it also has hallucinogenic properties. Right. So it's something that, it's actually used for, it's a veterinary anesthetic, right? It's a horse tranquilizer, basically. But it's not a barbiturate, no. Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about it later in this room. Okay. Special K. So I want to mention this because I think that there is a real issue here, but I think part of it is people shouldn't also just be paranoid. Off soapbox. Okay, back to class. It's a real thing, and it does happen. It does happen. It's a great article in the BBC about 2 years ago, and they had basically gone back to all the news reports, and then they got the police files and looked at them with the names blocked out. And they found out that almost all the time it was just people that had drank way, way too much. But there were cases where people had stuff put in their drinks. Okay. If you want a rapid effect, you go with intravenous. And this is why, for example, when, you know, if you are having a seizure, that's what they'll do. Right? Or if you need to be calmed down tremendously because of... Oh, I don't know. A lot of times after very long operations, especially brain and heart operations, people wake up with the symptoms that look just like paranoid schizophrenia. They wake up paranoid and hearing voices. It goes away. It's temporary. But I remember when my dad had his operation to remove part of his tumor in his brain, he woke up and he was really paranoid. And they eventually gave him some diazepam. Because my dad was a giant of a man and was trying to escape. You know, like he was really trying to get out, and, you know, nobody wanted to see him strapped to a bed and all that stuff. He'd just been through an operation, an 8-hour brain operation. So, yeah, he was given a little in his IV, and he calmed down. He was still paranoid, but he was calm. I remember him looking at me and yelling, "Why am I here?" And I said, "Well, Dad, they took part of your tumor out, man, and you're just recovering, and you'll be okay. Just give it some time." He said, he points right here. He goes, "What? Yeah, huh?" He couldn't speak very well because of his brain tumor that eventually killed him. But he's pointing at his arm and he's going, "Huh? Huh?" I said, "That is because you ripped IVs out of your arm." He goes, "No, no, no. Hang on a sec. Yes." Which is this really weird moment. But he needed it. And then, like a lot of times when people come out of these really long, and I didn't know about this, I was freaked. Then I went and read some stuff. Turns out people come out of long brain or heart operations they're under for a long time. It's for some reason, no one really knows why, they wake up paranoid. And again, if you just woke up, didn't know where you were, you're hooked up to all these tubes, I think I'd be a little bit pissed off too. Now, if long-term stuff, in other words, if you're using this here, there's just a little something to calm your nerves. Want to go with pills. This was a very common drug prescribed in the 60s and 70s. A lot of people took Valium. Right? Diazepam. In that case, you want a nice long therapeutic window, big therapeutic window, you go with oral. In about 30 minutes, taken orally, diazepam hits its peak in your system. So you take a Valium, it calms you right down. Absorption from the digestive system is greatly increased by taking alcohol. It's a super additive effect. Part of this is because the MEOS, the microsomal ethanol oxidizing system, is also used in the barbiturate metabolism. So it's busy doing something else. So if it's not breaking it down, it goes to your brain. It's really that simple. So you really shouldn't drink alcohol with these things. If you remember, again, I think I mentioned this, there were people, a bunch of cult members that killed themselves by taking a couple of shots of vodka and some phenobarbital. Because they thought they were all going up to a comet that was a ship and stuff. They all wore Nike shoes and purple jumpsuits. No, they did. The Heaven's Gate, I think it's called Heaven's Gate. Good people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does it actually increase your ability to drink alcohol if it takes longer for you to...
Wow. I don't think so. I've never heard that. I doubt that it could be... I can't see it being good for you. Doing both at the same time. Can't see it being good for you. And the thing is, the opiate system is separate from what I understand of the alcohol system. It's weird.
So that's why the two interfere with each other?
If they're interfering with each other, what that means is that, in fact, there's going to be more in the system. That's what's happening here, using the same metabolic pathway. The metabolic pathway for an opiate is so different from the metabolic pathway for alcohol. It seems strange to me. Hmm. Maybe the opiate makes it so you don't realize you're drunk. You know. It's a bad idea. Let's not combine our drugs. There's a great deal of variability here because we're talking about, first of all, two classes of drugs, benzodiazepines and barbiturates, and we're talking about a huge number of these drugs. So we're talking about a big family of drugs here, or two families, that are talked about in the same breath because, well, they have very similar effects. And the metabolism, the neuropharmacology is pretty similar. Pretty similar. Why did I call it the BB barrier? Because it would be the blood-brain barrier. Oh, no, that's right, blood-brain barrier. The more lipid-soluble of these drugs go through the blood-brain barrier more quickly. It makes some sense. It's made out of fat. They're redistributed to fat cells, so you end up with a biphasic curve. What do I mean by that? I mean, you get absorption, and then you get excretion, and then there's still some left, and you get a little more absorption and then excretion. It's not that uncommon. So the curve itself, the absorption-excretion curve, actually has two peaks. The first peak's higher, and it goes down, there's a second peak's a little bit lower, then it's out. Now, you'll hear me say this a lot of times too. Many of the metabolites themselves are psychoactive. So when it's being broken down, you're going to end up with it breaking it down into constituent parts, and some of those parts are also psychoactive. This is pretty common. They, of course, also cross the placental barrier too. Who wrote that sentence? Sarah Palin? Also crosses the placental barrier, or crosses the placental barrier too. Not also and too. This is good because what that means, not good, it's bad, but I mean it's good in that understanding is it means that when you take Valium, so does your baby. If you have a problem with this, with diazepam or phenobarbital or one of these kind of drugs, or even actually things like Quaaludes, when your baby's born, and if you've got a real issue where you get... withdrawal symptoms, your baby will be born going through withdrawal. Doesn't seem like a nice way to bring someone into the universe, does it? Okay, the physiology here, the pharmacology, show you this. These drugs modify the effect of GABA. Remember, GABA is universally inhibitory. What GABA does when a GABA receptor site is activated, it opens a chlorine ion channel. Right? Now, a chlorine ion channel is going to let more negative ions in. When more negative ions come in, it makes the cell more negative. Remember the resting potential, negative 70. If we make it more than negative 70, it makes it harder for the next neuron to fire. Right? So when you let chlorine in, that's how GABA is always inhibitory. Okay? So when you let chlorine in, it makes it harder to fire. By the way, the cell itself tries to get back to negative 70. But for momentarily, it's going to be less than negative 70. So basically, a higher negative number. What these drugs are positive GABA modulators. Okay? They're positive GABA modulators. They make GABA more effective. So GABA works better. At higher doses, depending on the drug, barbiturates can actually open an ion channel by themselves. So they stop acting like a modulator. They start actually acting like a neurotransmitter. They start acting like a GABA molecule when there's enough of them. See, a neuromodulator changes the effect of a neurotransmitter. Here's a good diagram. This is a nice diagram. Okay. This is a GABA receptor complex, okay? So here's the GABA receptor. There's a chlorine channel here, okay? So what happens is, what the solid line means, that this opens the neurotransmitter. Opens the ion channel. Solid line here means the same thing. Okay? Barbiturate receptors, because we have receptors for barbiturates, barbiturate receptors open the ion channel. Or the dashed line means they make the GABA receptor a little easier to open, basically. Benzodiazepines only work that way. They only work as modulators. All right? So you can see why these things would act as tranquilizers. They make the GABA system work better in both their cases. And at higher doses, barbiturates actually open chlorine ion channels, making neurons less likely to fire, neurons that have GABA receptors. Excuse me. Questions about that? This is a nice, easy one. It's better than I don't know how it works. We know how that one works. Barbiturates affect blood pressure. Benzodiazepines do not. In other words, barbiturates lower blood pressure. Benzodiazepines don't. Both, however, have anticonvulsant properties. As I mentioned, they're given for seizures. And I do remember my dad being on, I think it was diazepam, and because of the seizures. That's why they were giving it to him. But I have a friend who takes it too, and that's because she has epilepsy, totally controllable, basically. She takes it, and she's fine, but she has to take the drugs every day, just in case. Yep?
I think clonazepam is probably taken often over diazepam.
Oh, sure. I mean, it depends on whatever. In a hospital situation, you might even just be given Ativan. Yep.
Lorazepam.
Yeah. But it really depends on individuals, too. Like people that have epilepsy, it really depends on the person. Because some people, I mean, the hardest part about controlling epilepsy, of course, one of the hardest parts, first of all, finding the drug. But you have to find the right amount of the drug so the person isn't going to have seizures, but also isn't going to feel hammered all day. My friend who takes, and I think she actually takes diazepam, she has to drive a car all the time. So she's got to be really careful. And they had to get the dose just right because she has to drive all over Newfoundland for her job. And like she can't be like driving drunk, basically. So they got to find just the right, you know, they got to titrate it. But yeah, I think you're right. Benzodiazepines make excellent muscle relaxants. So does alcohol. Oh, it does. Alcohol does that pretty well. They have REM effects, both of them decreasing the amount of REM, like almost all drugs we will talk about. They make REM. You sleep, but you wake up tired. You know that kind of sleep? Because you haven't had REM, because REM is necessary for all kinds of things, including, you know, cognitive ability, growth hormones released during that, etc. There's all kinds of things. Healing your body. However, the next day, this is the problem. If you do this all the time, you never really probably get a really good night's sleep. And again, another problem with people that are epileptic is trying to give them just the right amount so they still have some REM sleep. You'll end up with REM rebound. So if you let's say you go into a hospital, you're all worked up about something, they give you a little bit. You'll sleep, but you won't have enough REM. The next night, however, you'll have what's called REM rebound, and you'll have a bigger chunk of your sleep that night devoted to REM. Okay? This happens as well with alcohol. In fact, you'll hear this. I think every single drug I talk about, I'll say this. First thing that happens is euphoria. It's like feeling drunk. Then there's something that's called liking. Liking means you're enjoying the drug, but it's beyond the euphoria thing. It's like, I like the way this makes me feel. It's called a drug like. It's a real term, too. I got it in quotes there, but it's a real term. And then after that, it's fatigue. It sounds a lot, when you think about it, like alcohol. Right? The effects sound very, very familiar, very similar. That you get the, oh, I'm crazy, it's like I'm drunk. And then it's like, this feels really good. I really enjoy this. Then it's like, oh, I got to go to bed. Right? They can lead to confusion. Again, I've never taken these, but people describe this as similar to being drunk. So you get sort of, you're confused. You have a decrease in visual acuity. I don't think you should probably drive a car, it sounds like. Divided attention becomes more difficult. Divided attention, psychological thing, where you can pay attention to more than one thing at the same time. Now, the problem here, of course, is, again, if you're driving a car, you have to pay attention to the road and everything else that's going on. And you're texting as you're driving, and you're full of Valium. This would be a bad combination. Reaction time increases, just like alcohol. It's interesting here as far as the memory effects. There are effects on acquisition. In other words, you have trouble learning things, but not recalling things. So you'll learn something. You have trouble learning it. The acquisition takes longer when you're taking, say, Valium than it takes when you haven't taken any. But recalling something, if I teach you a list of words before you take the drug, then you take the drug, you'll do just as well on the... And again, if this is in moderate amounts. This isn't if you've taken half a bottle full. That'll kill you. Doesn't seem to show any recall effects. And this is actually true with both humans and like rats. Yeah, Steph. You will, if you learn something while you're on the drug, you're going to remember it better while you're on the drug.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will you remember after?
You will, but not as well as you would have had you not taken the drug. You get a hangover. Like an actual same sort of thing, head hurts, throwing up. Don't drive a car. This should all tell you. These here, the top four here, confusion, decrease in visual acuity, divided attention difficulties, and your reaction time increasing, should tell you you should not be driving a car. I still try to figure out how the hell Andrea drives a car every day all over Newfoundland, but I've been in a car with her. Ah, that's good, right? Just driving along, everything's fine. I don't know. I guess they got the dosage right. You get more exploration in lab animals. I think I told you how you test this spontaneous motor activity. You have a table. You set up some photo beams, okay? And then you put the rat down, and the rat runs around, and you count how many photo beams he breaks. You get more of that in when you give him either of these drugs, benzodiazepines or barbiturates. That's probably that whole disinhibition thing. Typically, rats won't just run around all over a table. Seems odd, doesn't it? But it's disinhibition. Could be, at least. Yes, Steph?
Do they know if this happens in humans as well?
Yes, it's the same thing, the disinhibition thing. It's the same kind of thing that happens with you. You would be silly.
I had a call about the hospital pharmacy, and Advil and diazepam were like the drugs with the highest getting pumped out.
Yeah.
Wouldn't this get patients wandering the hospital?
No, because they tend to be given in enough that they get them calm and they relax and they go to sleep. It's probably less anxiety as well. They're also anti-anxiety medications, right? They're given. They can be given if people are really anxious. This is not a drug that's given for an anxiety disorder. Typically, it can be. Typically, now we use SSRIs, antidepressants, for these. But in the past, especially, it was used quite a bit, both these classes of drugs, for people that had all kinds of anxiety problems, obsessive-compulsive disorder, agoraphobia, that kind of thing. Because it does release anxiety, reduce anxiety, for sure. Right? You get an increase in fixed ratio responding and a decrease in fixed interval responding. Remember what fixed ratio was? That's the thing where, let's say, that's the ratio of responses to reinforcements. So you give an animal, let's say, one pellet of food every 10th time he pushes the bar. Okay? A fixed interval is you give him food for the first response after 10 seconds. So what this is doing is it's messing with the clock by the looks of it, because you got the animal has to keep track of time. Makes some sense. You get less FI responding. It's probably slowing the clock down. Timing and counting, because FR involves counting, right? You have to actually count the animal has to count the number of bar presses it's done. The timing system and the counting system are related. Okay? So it's probably this is probably just a timing effect. You get an increase in punished behavior. This is probably because of the anxiety. Okay, punished behavior, what that means, like you got half the box is going to be, electrified, and the rat walks over there, you get shocked. They learn pretty quickly not to go over there. But if you give them phenobarbital, they'll wander over. Probably, again, less anxiety and a disinhibition thing. There are dissociative effects. That's what I was talking about. When you learn something on the drug, it's easier to remember it back on the drug. It's still better to learn something off the drug because you still learn better that way. But these dissociative effects happen all the time with all kinds of drugs. They're retrieval cues. That's all they are. Acute tolerance develops right away to these things. So you take one, the next one has much less of an effect than the first one if you take, say, Pop and Valiums. Chronic tolerance, the first thing it develops to is the sort of depressant effects. In other words, the sort of alcohol-y type side effects. Okay? Then it develops to the anti-anxiety effects. Within benzodiazepines, there's cross-tolerance. In other words, if you are Ativan, diazepam, these are all, if you're tolerant to one, you're going to be tolerant to all of them. There's some cross-tolerance between barbiturates and alcohol, which makes us think that the mechanism's similar, and we know about using the MIOS, right? For barbiturates, withdrawal involves REM rebound, tremors, insomnia. This all sounds like the opposite of being calm, because that's what it is. Nausea, I don't know about that. Seizures, sure. Hallucinations, whoops, I should go back. If I didn't think I was over there. Wow. Well, that's not good. None of those look fun. Yep.
Can their withdrawals be fatal?
Yes. It's pretty similar, as you can see by the things, pretty similar to alcohol withdrawal. Alcohol withdrawal is probably worse, though. It can be, but it's not as bad as withdrawal from, you know, for a real alcoholic getting the... But you might end up, not barbiturates, but benzodiazepines, you can get the DTs, the whole thing. It's very similar. And, yeah, people can die. Yep. These used to be used a lot as sleeping pills, and it's not a great idea to use these, because they still are to some point. They, you get pretty tolerant of them pretty quickly, and they're very unpleasant to go off of. For benzodiazepines, you get agitated, you get depressed. Well, this sounds horrible. It hurts. The DTs, there you are. REM rebound. That's what the only good one, huh? And you get two-stage withdrawal, right? Because first, remember what I said before? First, you had the depressant effects. Then you have the anti-anxiety effects. So you're going to get withdrawal first to the anti-anxiety effects, then to the depressive effects. So you're going to get the opposite of one. Withdrawal is almost always the opposite of the effect of the drug, and then the opposite of the other. Most people will not choose to take these. Okay? Most people. Some will, and usually if it's if they have a history of alcohol abuse or other sedatives. Okay? And if you show a drug-liking reaction to alcohol, you are more likely, I shouldn't say you will like them, because I just said most people won't. So, but if you show a drug-liking reaction to alcohol, you are more likely to show to enjoy taking these drugs. You're more likely to show a liking reaction to these. But still, most people don't. One of the problems here is you get this use, iatrogenic use, which is this whole idea of going, doing that whole doctor shopping thing, which is a little harder to do nowadays. That's like House. You watch House, right? This is the idea. You know, in fact, what you go in and go, I'm really anxious, and I'm really agitated, and I've been having, it's like my body just, you know, I start shaking uncontrollably. Oh, well, you know, of course, what you're saying there is give you some, oh, I don't know, Ativan. Good, there you are. Here's some diazepam. Excellent. And it used to be a lot easier for people to do this because they know how to get the drug. And it's a legal drug that has perfectly good medical uses. A little harder now that everything's all networked up. I've talked to pharmacists before. They tell me, you know, oh, no, you type in somebody's name and it comes up. It's like, no, you've already had 4 prescriptions today. Right? This is why we need things like electronic health records, I think, and stuff like that. So there's sharing of information to stop people from doing this kind of stuff. Yeah. Street use is either just doing it on its own or using it to sort of smooth out a speed rush. Or if you're doing a speedballs, which is like, you know, speed and heroin, hard to get heroin, maybe, and get some Valium. Sort of smooths it out. Put it together. That's, by the way, what killed John Belushi. It was heroin and speed, John Belushi. I think I was going to say, I think Chris Farley has killed all, you know, kind of fat guys on Saturday Night Live. But Chris Farley, have you heard that story? I mean, those 2 or 3 days before he died, like, he was just completely wasted the whole time, apparently.
I saw a clip of him on, I think it was some talk show, and he was just sweating, and he was just all like, just...
Yeah, and it was always hard to tell if he was acting doing that, or is that... And now when you look back, you think, I think it might have been some of the drugs. Yeah. Yeah, but I think you're right. I think Chris Farley also died from doing speedballs. Kids, don't do speedballs. Imagine that. I'm doing a lot of speed, and to smooth it out, a little heroin. Just when I get over that rough patch... Yeah, let's see, where are we? What's the next slide? Oh, yeah, let's do bad stuff, and then we'll stop for today, because that's a good place to stop. We're almost done anyway. Birth defects, barbiturates for sure. Benzodiazepines, maybe a good guess. Newborns do go through withdrawal if the mother is using these drugs. Even, by the way, if she's using them prescription, whatever. The question that's then asked of mothers that are taking these, say, for anti-seizure, things like that, is how can you go off the drug and how much can you go off it? Because, I mean, maybe it's an unpleasant way to enter the world, but it'll go away. They can have what are on fetuses, demasculinizing effects. So little boys don't develop to be completely little boys. They can lead to aggression, violence. That's that whole anti-anxiety plus the sort of disinhibition. Here's something beautiful. The lethal dose shows tolerance, but the effective dose... shows no tolerance. I was going to say that's impossible. Shows no tolerance, but the effective dose does. So you see, the more you take them, the more likely you are to kill yourself. So you need more, but the LD50 doesn't change. So see, the more you take, ED50 starts to approach LD50. You're more likely to kill yourself. And on that happy, happy note, you have a test on Wednesday and on everything up to the bad stuff that happens with these drugs. Thanks, guys.
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.